We're talking about problems and coping with them. We've been talking about personal problems, having discussed some basic other kinds, impersonal, cultural ones before that. Now, we have talked about problems of the personal kind in terms of a certain basic formulation, the IFD pattern, as we've called it, from idealism to frustration to demoralization. And the last hour, we were talking about particularly the relation of language behavior to problems as defined in that way, IFD. The last thing that I wanted to say, and I will now try to summarize briefly, had to do with the formulation of the problems we have. When you're asked, what is the matter, when the people who come to clinics are asked, what is the matter, they're usually sort of vague about it. Or they may be overly specific. One of the very most important parts of coping with a problem is to be able to say clearly what the problem is like. Problems can best, as a rule, be stated in the form of questions. And if the questions are vague or meaningless, we tend to be frustrated in our attempts to find answers for them. Don't know what to look for. So we need to ask questions that we can answer by means of observations that we can make or that others have made, which are available to us. We need to tell ourselves in clear descriptive language what we observe or what others have observed. And we need to test, to review, and to revise, if necessary, the conclusions at which we have come beforehand in the light of the new information we now have as a result of the observations we have made to answer the questions we have asked. And having revised our attitudes or beliefs, conclusions, they now take the form of new questions to be asked so they can be answered by observations that can be made and reported accurately enough, that is, in language clearly enough, to be relevant to the conclusions which generated the questions. Well, this turns out to be essentially the scientific method. And today I want to relate this then to a larger context. What do you do about problems in general, personal or not? What is the method that you would use if you don't use a scientific method to deal with problems? There's an awful lot of talk, an awful lot of things that have been stated, published, to the effect that there's a limitation to what you can do with the methodology that we call scientific. There's some things you can't be scientific about. I think this deserves very, very serious discussion. And one of the major questions to ask is, when you are not behaving scientifically, when you are not trying to cope with a problem scientifically, what are you doing? Are you using another method? If you are, what is it? How would you describe it? If you're not using a method, what are you doing? I think the answers that we make to such questions will depend very much upon what we understand by these words. What do you mean by being scientific? What do you mean by not being scientific? Now, we immediately discover something when we attempt to grapple with this kind of question. Something very puzzling. What name are you going to give the approach to problems which you will not call scientific? We'll use that name for one approach, but what will we call the other? The difficulty we have answering this immediately points up part of the problem. What do you call it? In the book, the end of chapter 4, I call it pre-scientific. I'm thinking there in terms of development of the scientific method. What did we do before we had it? But pre-scientific is not too happy a term, probably. It's a negative kind of term, you see. It doesn't say anything. It says simply that it isn't scientific. Well, the only word I've ever been able to come upon that seemed to have been used in the past in such ways as to represent something positive and that could be contrasted with what we mean by the word scientific is the word magic or magical. We can contrast magic and science. We can contrast magical and scientific. This is a very respectable word. It's used by scholars. Many very fine books have been written about the magical orientation, the magical way of thinking, and it has been contrasted with the scientific in many such books. And there is a surprising degree of agreement, as I read, about these matters. And I'd like today to summarize the contrast. I've tried to do this at the end of chapter 4 of People in Quandaries. If you have read that far, you will follow better today what I have to say. I have a number of terms I want to use, pairs of terms I want to use. Contrast these two kinds of orientation. According to what is ordinarily meant by magic, the magician tends to assume an essentially static kind of reality, a constancy. There are similarities, there are types, there are kinds of things, and magical change consists essentially of transformations from one kind of thing to another. There is no very well-defined process involved. Things are just somehow magically transformed. The coach is turned into a pumpkin. There is no process involved here. If you think about yourself in magical terms, you do a lot of what we call wishing. Wishing you could be good looking, wishing you could be rich, wishing you could be popular, wishing you could be whatever. And you're looking for a good fairy with a wand that will be very effective. Well, a scientific orientation, you don't tend to think this way. The emphasis is upon processes, transformations that go through a series of stages that have some kind of developmental pattern to them. The learning process, the growth process, etc. Scientists are much concerned with such processes. But you don't have to be a scientist. I want to emphasize this. I'm talking about an orientation, not a specialist working in a laboratory. That doesn't interest me much. I'm talking about how you can behave scientifically from moment to moment every day, not in a laboratory somewhere, after years and years of specialized training. Now, I'm not interested in that. I'm talking about behavior, your own behavior. What would you do if you were to think and talk and behave scientifically? What would you do if you were to think and talk and behave magically? And I want to emphasize these are extremes of a continuum. And most of us vary along this somewhere with some sort of a rough modal trend. On the average, we are more scientific or more magical, and think of it as a scale. And you are sometimes more magical than at other times, or more scientific than at other times, in your behavior and in the way you talk and the way you think. And you develop over the years, presumably. You move along this scale. Which way are you moving? Or are you? I won't get done today. I'm pretty short. It's hard to go fast with this. I think these things are so fundamental and not too easy to understand in terms which would come alive in the way you would act if you understood. If you understood, if you acted as though you understood this, and you wanted to behave more scientifically, you would pay much more attention to differences than to similarities, much more attention to how people differ one from another, or how the same individual differs from time to time, than you would to how people are alike and how they stay the same. If you are scientifically oriented to a high degree, you would not say to a returning friend, "My, you look just the same as ever." This would be an insult. Hasn't he changed? Hasn't he grown? Is he really just the same as ever? Or is he only to you just the same as ever? Aren't you interested in how he might be different? Our popular songs tend to reflect the common folk orientation, and it's pretty largely magical, of course. "Stay the Same as You Are" is a rather popular song that has many titles and many tunes. Almost as though there were some kind of a deep desire on the part of most people not to change and not to have anybody else change and for nothing to change. This is magical. This goes with a magical orientation. People who like change, who are adventurous, who go looking for change, who try to bring it about, and this kind of thing goes with being scientifically oriented. If you don't pay much attention to differences, the individual doesn't matter much to you. He is not important as Sam Jones, but only as a Negro or a white or an Arab or a Jew or a Catholic or a Protestant or some such member of some such group. And if, so far as you are magically oriented, you tend to be oriented to groups, to types, to kinds of people, not to people, not to individuals. To the degree that you are scientifically oriented, you are interested in the individual. You don't really pay much attention to his color or his collar. Almost too obviously to labor it, that if you are oriented in this essentially static way of the magician, you tend to be rigid, to be resistant to change, to value very highly tradition, to value very highly the authority of age and precedence. And to the degree that you are oriented in the other way, the other end of the continuum, to process scientifically, you tend to be adaptable to change, to be ready to change, to place a high value on improvement, on innovation, on creativity, on doing things differently, not just for different sake, but because it's the only way you can do them better. You tend to place high value on the authority not of age and precedence, not that you have disrespect for age, precedence, not at all. It's just that you value more the authority of observation and evaluated experience. The one kind of orientation, the rigidity, the high valuation on tradition, on authority with a capital A, the authority of age and precedence, tends to make for a kind of immaturity. Infantilism is a name that has been used for it. A tendency not to explore one's own thinking, not to develop one's own potential for original thinking. But the other kind of orientation does this. It does tend to encourage the individual in seeking for change, in being adaptable, in being concerned with processes, in being highly attached to the authority of evaluated experience and observation, to trust his own nervous system, to look with his own eyes, to hear with his own ears, to have his own thoughts. The emphasis tends, therefore, to be on maturity, development of personal maturity. So you don't ask others, what should I believe, what should I think? You do your own believing. in your own thinking on the basis of your own observations, your own evaluations of others' observations. Problem-solving behavior, or let's use another word. Under magical, authoritarian problem-coping behavior. Let's use that word. You don't always solve the problems. You cope with them. I'm going to use the word scientific. Problem coping. To the degree that you are magically oriented, you tend to abide by the advice of someone else. You tend to, when you have a problem, you don't tend to solve it yourself, as we say. You tend to try to find a person who is an answer man for you. You go to Papa, in some sense of this phrase. I'm using Papa here in as a generic term. We have a feeling for this word, Papa. You find Papa when you get into trouble, so far as you are magically oriented. You look for Papa. And you find him in some form. You take his advice. And this you tend to do in company with others. You get tremendous satisfaction out of sharing conclusions, beliefs, ideas as to what's the best thing to do. You share these. You like to share them with others. You get support that way for your own feelings to the degree that you are magically oriented. To the degree that you are scientifically oriented, you tend to follow the procedure that I described briefly at the beginning of the hour. You try to state the problem in the form of questions. You do this yourself. Questions which you can answer by means of observations which you can make or that others have made, which you can share by reading or by somehow finding the information. And you report these observations, especially to yourself, as accurately and honestly as you can. You're not trying to make yourself feel good, you're trying to make yourself informed. And then you test your relevant attitudes, beliefs, assumptions, and information against this report of the best information you can get, the best observations you can make or find out about. And of course, you don't answer the questions once and for all. There is a constant generation of these questions, because problems are not so much something that you have and solve forever. Problems are a part of daily living. What matters is not what problems you have, but how you're coping with them. You're going to have problems all your life. It's how you cope with them that determines what kind of a life you have. Problems are stimulating. Problems are what keep you mentally alive, emotionally alive, if you use those terms. The language that is involved here needs to be contrasted. I'll just put the word language here. So far as you are magically oriented, you tend to use language in which statements of assumption, of supposition, and statements of fact tend to be confused with each other. You tend to confuse is with perhaps, or is with maybe, or is with looks like. There is not very much consciousness of, or behavior as though there were consciousness of, levels of language. Language is responded to as though it were overvalued, as though it were more, as though the statements obtained from Papa, from the authority that is, were more dependable than they probably are. Their validity tends not to be questioned. If the statement seems not to be clear or to be self-contradictory or something of this sort, the authority, Papa, will explain it. Now, to the degree that you are scientifically oriented, your language seems to reflect a high valuation on clarity, on validity. You do a good deal of asking whoever tells you anything, and asking of yourself, what do you mean? How do you know? How good is your evidence? And there is constant attention to the distinction to be made between statements that are descriptive, that are reports of observations, that are, as we say, factual, and statements that are about assumptions, that are basically suppositions. The questions in these two kinds of orientation are of interest. I'll just put down the word question. The most important thing about the questions that you tend to ask, to the degree that you are magically oriented, or if you are, is that they tend to be vague or meaningless in the technical sense of that term, which means that it is practically not possible to tell where to look for the answer, what to do to get it. For instance, you ask things like, am I successful? Am I normal? Am I good? Now, or you ask things like, why am I here? What is the purpose of life? Now, these you will immediately recognize as questions which you have always thought of as being tremendously important. And one of the arguments that you hear much is that the trouble with science is that it can't deal with these questions. Now, if you look at these questions as samples of language, And if you ask yourself, is there any way to make the question a little more manageable? Could you ask it better in the sense that it would be easier to answer? Not that we're looking for easy answers, we're looking for possible answers. We want answers. Answers are terribly important. Without answers, you can become utterly demoralized. Well, to the degree that you are scientifically oriented, you will tend to fuss with these questions and try to revise them, try to reword them. You will work at trying to ask the kinds of questions that can be answered. Now, this doesn't mean that you abandon anything important. You just try to make it more manageable. What is it you want to know, you keep asking yourself? What is it you want to observe in order to find out what you want to know? Where would you go to observe it? What would you have to do to observe it? Now, if you have to come up with the ultimate answer, there isn't anything I can observe to answer what I want to know, I think you need to go off on your mountaintop and ask yourself, where does that leave you? How do you answer questions for which it is not possible to make any observations at all, either you or anybody else? You say, but there are people who can answer these questions. Well, how do they answer them? You answer that for yourself. This we can observe, that there are consequences of offering answers to unanswerable questions. The consequences are that you tend to stir up disagreement. And the kind of disagreement that is practically hopeless. You can't resolve it. There is no way to check. If you say tis and I say taint, and neither one of us know what we're talking about, and if we somehow are oriented to feel that we must defend our positions because they are what we call right, what will we eventually do but spring for each other's necks? There are terrible consequences of answering unanswerable questions. If you ask the kind of questions, if you, that is, formulate the question, if you work at it, if you are painstaking and responsible and conscientious in the way you word the question, if you are willing to put some time on it and to be careful, then you tend to ask the kind of questions that people can agree about the answers to, if that's a sentence. Because if I ask a question like, how many matches are there in the box? And there's a box here. We can open the box up and count them, and we will agree on the answer. If you ask me, whether you are a good person, and you refuse to put any more time on the question than that, and when I ask, well, how would I know what to look for in order to answer this? And you just say, well, I don't want to be scientific about it. This is a too important question to do that. I want to know whether I am good. This is important to me. Well, it's rather difficult to communicate with such a person, but uh, Suppose I can persuade you to ask it so that we can answer it. You see, if we don't do this, and I say, no, you're not a good person, this is going to make you feel terrible if you regard me with any kind of respect. On the other hand, if I say, yes, you're a good girl, a good boy, and you don't know what I mean, this is very confusing to you. You don't know what I have said. And so you go right on doing the dastardly things you are doing with the conviction that you're very good, as I've told you you are. This is a horrible mess. Now, what is it you want to know? When you ask, are you good? Are you living a good life? What are you asking? What do you want me to look for? What do you want me to check up on? What do you want to check up on? Well, you answer it. And when you're ready to tell me what to look for, I'll go look. But I would be doing you a great disservice to pretend that I know what you mean when I don't. This is a form of very pernicious dishonesty by my standards. I should not let you get away with that kind of vagueness or meaninglessness. It's not good for you. It's not good for me to be in a relationship with someone who insists on that kind of vagueness, especially under the guise that it isn't only necessary, but it is somehow lofty. The point is that when you can ask questions so that reasonably honest and dependable and conscientious people can figure out what to look for in order to get the answers, you tend to foster agreement, mutual confidence, understanding, because people can agree when they know what to agree about. There's another term I'll use, the one that I use in the book, a hyphenated word that I have coined, because the technical term for this is the term projection, but people seem to have difficulty with that word. To-me-ness is a little more, I don't know, less formidable, perhaps. Let me draw a diagram to tell you what I mean. You know, we're always using models to explain things. We have developed in the last few years some very wonderful cameras, developers, and film projectors. Now let's put them together, make a machine, which is a model for a man. Now here's a camera. This is a dandy camera. High speed, sound, color, wonderful. And this is a developer. These are builders. And this is a film projector. We'll hook them all together. This is the viewing screen against which we're going to see whatever we see, projection we're talking about. So now you're going to look at something. You'll say you're going to look at your wife or your husband or your mother or your father or someone who matters to you, a person. Now reality, let's put over here, and we'll put quotation marks around it. You see reality, we will say, as though through a screen, viewing screen, and how much of it gets through to be viewed by you depends upon to be viewed by you. You're a camera. Take a picture. Depends upon what you are yourself projecting.
and how strong a projection it is. If it is sufficiently strong, you will see your own projection and nothing else. Now, so you take a picture, you look. I'm looking at you, you're looking at me. What do you see? Well, what are you projecting? What does the word professor mean to you? Do you really see me? What does student mean to me? Do I really see you? I see something. I'm taking a picture. And I'm a camera. I'm a dandy. And the film goes right up into the film to the developer immediately. And I develop the film. We'll come back to this. And then it goes up here, and I immediately project my picture of you. What do I see? Do I see you as you really are? What is Jack Parr really like? No? What?
How could you find out? This is an example of a meaningless question, you see. One of these questions that results in confusion, disagreement, and if it's a very important kind of a question to the people concerned, it may result in a terrible fight. Because there's no way to answer it. What is Jack Parr really like? What are we to look for to find out? What do you mean by really? When this is the situation you're dealing with.
What do you really see? What do you mean by really?
Really. Really. Say it 10 times and go mad.
I said that there were filters here. You know, mood filters. Two people, one has just had a letter from his girlfriend saying that she's ready to marry him, and the other's just had a letter from home saying that mother has died. Now, they're looking at the same thing. They will give very different reports.
Because their projections are different. You all know about mood filters. There are doctrinal filters. They're Buddhist filters and Baptist filters. There are Republican filters and Democrat filters. There are communist filters and what's the name for the other one? Democrat, I guess. I think so. That's what I think. Democrat. Not capitalist, because I think communists are capitalists, too. Technically. It's just that they use a different bookkeeping system. So you have all kinds of doctrinal filters that you're operating with. And two people don't really see the same thing. Does that mean that one sees the wrong thing and one sees the right thing? How would you answer that? It's another meaningless question. They just see differently. Probably the most fateful kind of filter in your developer, inside your head, is a language filter. You've learned a language. And you filter everything that comes in through your eyes and ears through that language system. And it comes out here in the form of words, the words available to you, and the patterns for arrangement which you have learned, and none other. And this places a very great limitation on what you can say. And it places a great limitation on what you can see. You tend to see what you have names for, and nothing else. Your language not only does your thinking for you, it does your looking for you to a high degree. if you are magically oriented, or to the degree that you are, you disregard all that. You don't know about it, or if you do, you ignore it, or you deny it. If you know it and you deny it, then of course you're a fraud. If you just don't know it, you're an innocent. To the degree that you are scientifically oriented, you know about all that. And you talk as though you did. And you evaluate what you say as though you did, as though you knew. You're talking not about the world out there necessarily, but about your own projections. And so there's a lot of to-me-ness in your language behavior. My alarm is about to go off, and I'm certainly not through. I've come to a good place to stop, and this alarm is about to go off. I'll see you Monday.